You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Brian Callen Show without Brian Callen. Why is Brian Callen not here? Because he's working desperately as an actor and hoping one day that he might win one Emmy. And my guest has, in fact, already four Emmys, so he's already like set the bar so high that Brian will never even hope to come close to it. Sorry, Brian. That's right. Four-time Emmy-winning documentary filmmaker, writer, and anthropologist Kim McCorry, who's written a whole bunch of books all about the Andes and the Incas, including what I would say is the definitive book on the Inca, and I think a lot of people would agree, The Last Days of the Incas. Kim McCorry, you're here to talk about your latest book, Life and Death in the Andes.
Hey, thanks. Thanks very much. Thanks for having me. Delighted to be here.
Yeah, and so why don't we? I mean, you know, it's interesting. I mean, you know, I'm not sure where you grew up, but you ended up becoming obsessed with, you know, the Andes, and you know, I think your first love was really Peru.
Yeah, that's right. I actually grew up in Nevada, and you know, I grew up in Nevada in Southern California, and I think that just by having grown up in Southern California some of the time and going down to the border of Mexico, I got really interested in Latin America. You know, initially go like to Tijuana and you see them selling hats and those kinds of things, but if you're a kid, it's pretty exciting. And I started doing trips, you know, down to Mexico. When I was in college, I would take like red-eye flights down to Mexico, and the further south I got, the more interesting it became. And then eventually I went down to Central America, and I finally got to South America.
And yeah, and so in your latest book, you're really traveling up and down the spine of the Andes, and it's, you know, it's part travelogue, it's partly traveling, but it's also really, I mean, it serves as a collection of the greatest hits of everything that you've ever seen in South America, the best stories, the best experiences, the most interesting sights.
Yeah, because, I mean, I started, yeah, the book is about traveling from northern Colombia all the way down to the tip in Tierra del Fuego, so that's 4,300 miles, and so I was always interested in doing that voyage. I'd been to South America, lived in South America, lived in Peru and the Amazon, that kind of thing. But I was always in the back of my mind to do a trip from north to south. And so that was kind of the spine of the book. And then because I'm a writer, I wanted to go to places that had, you know, interesting stories. So I found out some of the most interesting stories that I thought existed in South America and went and visited those places.
The spine of the book and also the spine of the continent. I mean, that's part of what really comes through in the book is just the sheer size of that mountain range and of South America in general, which I don't think that you realize. Like, if you look at one of those Mercator maps with the distortions where it's all stretched out, you know, I mean, Canada looks so vast. And just because, you know, South America is a little bit, you know, landmass top heavy, you don't really get the full extent of how big the continent is.
Yeah, it's giant. The United States would easily fit inside there. And until you've been there, you can't, you know, it's hard to hear about the Himalayas. It's, you know, similar to that. There's over 20,000 foot peaks. You know, when Hernando Cortez talked to the King of Spain about the geography of Mexico, the king said, well, what's Mexico like? And then the apocryphal story is that Cortez took a sheet of paper and crumpled it up and said, and threw it on the table and said, that's what Mexico looks like. By comparison, the Andes in South America, it would make that look like a pike, or it would look like a little scrap of paper. I mean, just, it's enormous. It's a piece of paper that would fill the room full of crumples. You know, if it was a model. So yeah, it's epic.
Yeah, and we were talking about this a little bit before the interview, but I did a trip this summer to Peru and, you know, went on, as I usually do, go on Amazon, look around, see what books are available on the topic, see what the best reviewed are. And of course, you know, your book, Last Days of the Inca, was clearly like the book if you want to know about the Inca Empire and, you know, sort of about that period of history and about what that means for Peru today. You and Hernando de Soto were like the two Peru books that I had to read before I went there.
Oh, right. Well, thank you. You put me in good company there.
Great company. Yeah. I mean, and that's the thing is, so, I mean, you know, why don't you tell us a little bit about how, so there's this process of like working your way down the spine of the continent and then, you know, but really Peru, you know, you spent a whole bunch of time there in the 80s, right? And 90s, you said about 4 years in total.
Yeah, I went to school down there. I did graduate studies at the Catholic University down there, and I went into that program, study abroad program, because I was just so fascinated by Peru. And in Peru itself, they commonly say, like, there's three different worlds in Peru. There's the coast, which is kind of dry, bone dry desert. On the coast right there, then there's the Andes, which which are gigantic, enormous, and then 60% of Peru is like the Amazon jungle. And in a sense, the country is like these three different worlds all crushed together, or squished together with a flag on top that says Peru, but they're really, they're such distinct worlds that you can spend a lot of time there, you know, in exploring all that.
Yeah, and I mean, Lima, I mean, it was funny, when I was down there, I actually met with some of the people from DeSoto's organization, and they were saying that, you know, Lima reminds them a lot of L.A., and it's totally true. It's that, it is that very sort of dry, coastal California feel, and so obviously so different from, say, Cusco, the Andes, or from the Amazon.
Yeah, because the trade winds come across the South America from east to west, and they have all the moisture from the rainforest and from the Atlantic. And they, when they hit the Andes, they dump all of that there, and that's where the Amazon comes from. And so it's like a rain shadow on the other side. And then on the western side of Peru, it's the Humboldt Current, which is really cold, so it, so water does not really evaporate from the ocean like it normally would, like off California, and go inland and drop, it just stays there. So they're in a rain shadow, and they're next to a really frigid, cold current there. So they're kind of in this super, it's like the Sahara Desert on the coast. There's like nothing growing there. But the great thing about that is there's so many civilizations that have been there that preserves the ruins and all the archaeology like perfectly. There's just, it's a perfect preservation chamber in a way on the coast.
And especially for a lot of that sort of, I think it's the Mochi culture, where they have like a lot of a lot of it's mud brick and stuff like that, which in any other environment would have been washed away.
100%. Yeah, yeah. There's pyramids all over Peru and the Mochi culture and pre-Inca, pre-Mochi cultures. Still, adobe pyramids up and down the coast. In fact, in Lima, I don't know if you saw that, but if you, in Lima, it's a very urban city, but here and there you'll see this giant pyramid of adobe stones or adobe bricks there. And only when El Nino hits, which is hitting this year, does it rain on the coast. So like every 7 years there'll be a deluge, and that's what does actually erode things. But other than that, it's bone dry. It's just no water drops on the coast.
Yeah, and the 80s and 90s were an interesting time to be in Peru. And I think, you know, I mean, we'll talk about this, but you cover this in the book, the intersection between that and the Inca, right? So in the 80s and 90s, you have this group called the Shining Path. And, you know, it's a Maoist group, and they're basically trying to bring about land reform and all of that sort of stuff. But so, I mean, it was so dangerous. I mean, you talked about how they would have a shoot on site policy when you would go out at night.
The government did. They put a, what do you call it, a toque de queda, which is a curfew, basically. So after 10 p.m., between 10 p.m. and 5 a.m. In the city, in the capital, because there's been so many bomb explosions and attacks by the Shining Path, they put in this curfew where they would shoot on anybody on site that didn't have a pass. And of course, it's kind of hard to display your pass. It's in your wallet. So basically, people just totally stayed off the streets. Or if you were in a taxi or you had to travel, you'd put a white flag on the antenna, which meant that, of your car, which meant that, you know, you had a pass, and then you'd be stopped. But yeah, it was pretty spooky. It was pretty spooky there to be out at night.
And so,
not to do that.
Yeah, and so how did that and that experience influence your interest in the Inca? I mean, do you think that it reinforced this idea of like a guerrilla warfare and fighting against the government and, you know, looking at that in a historical context?
Well, it's an interesting question. I mean, I went down there to do graduate studies, and I was super interested in the Amazon. So I always intended to go out and look at a culture, you know, a culture in the Amazon. And I ended up living with a recently contacted tribe out there. And the irony is that this tribe, the Yaminawa, they'd been contacted a few years prior to when I arrived, and they had been known for keeping any explorers, anybody, oil people, just anybody out of their territory. And they had these big, big bows, 6 foot tall bows, and these big, big arrows. And if you went anywhere near that, they would shoot you with them.
Mm-hmm.
So they were kind of known as being very tough, very fierce, very dangerous. And when I was there, the Shining Path had been going since 1980, so I didn't arrive until 1986. I was there from 1986 to 1990, so that was really heating up during that time. It reached its peak about 1990, 1991, the Shining Path movements. But the natives there in this tribe was asking me what it was like, they'd heard about the Shining Path, and so I was trying to explain it to them. And so I basically said, I broke it down to like, you know, what they understood, because they would raid neighboring native Amazonian Indian villages, and they would, you know, steal their stuff and kill their men and, you know, take all their goods and steal a few women. And I said, well, you know how you raid the Machi Genga? And they go, yeah. I said, it's like that, except it's over there over the mountains. They go, oh, okay, we get it.
So also, how are you communicating with them if they, you know, only recently been contacted? I mean, did they...
Well, I basically, they're monolingual. I basically learned their language, and there was another tribe, I mean, to speak it basically, and there was another tribe there that that had been acculturated, and they spoke a very similar dialect. So sometimes for interviews and that kind of thing, I would bring in one of them, and we do formal interviews. Right, write down, you know, word for word what they were saying. But they were super curious about what, you know, what was outside of their little area, and mm-hmm. they're super interested, you know, what was up over the mountains and their ancestors that had contact with the Incas in the past. They still had oral stories floating around there, and there were still Inca axes, like bronze axes, that showed up in these villages that have been traded for 500 years, so that got me kind of interested in the whole Inca aspect initially, but how the Incas kind of dealt with these cultures down in the Amazon and how far the Incas had gone into the Amazon. I was curious about that.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's the interesting thing, right? So, I mean, just for anybody who has not yet read The Last Days of the Inca, and you absolutely should, you know, just to provide the sort of brief overview, right? And I understand that you're currently doing a live action dramatic series with FX that's going to cover The Last Days of the Inca, right?
That's right. It's in development right now at FX. They want to do a 13-part dramatic series based on the book. And Andrew McDonald, who's a producer, has worked a lot with Danny Boyle. Like, he produced Trainspotting and some films like that. He's the producer that's working on that. So it's a co-production between his company in the UK and FX. So that's pretty exciting.
Is there any chance we could get Brian Callen cast as Pachacuti?
No problem. I mean, they're based in L.A., so hey.
Yeah, why not?
Why not? Yeah, you've been down there. You know the area, so
yeah.
You especially. Yeah.
I mean,
easy to plug in there.
And Brian is half Sicilian, so I mean, I feel like he looks kind of Inca already. But so, yeah, I mean, the amazing thing, right? I mean, both with, you know, Cortez's conquest of Mexico and also with Pizarro's conquest of Peru and the Inca Empire is just like how few conquistadors there were and how many of the natives there were.
Yeah, that was the largest Native American empire that ever existed, the one the Incas put together. And they did it really fast, like within under, you know, 90 years, they built mm-hmm. that whole empire about 3,000 miles in length. The Andes, which, as I was saying, is like such a, you know, incredibly, you know, tumultuous terrain to run an empire over. That be like running the empire all the way up the Colorado Mountains. If the Colorado Mountains were almost twice as high, it's crazy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to link it with roadways and messengers and just do all that stuff, you know, it's like incredible. But the estimates there are that there's roughly 10 million people lived in the Inca Empire. When the conquistadors arrived with Francisco Pizarro, it was 168 Spaniards and about 80 horses, and the rest of them were on foot. And so that's a big thing the book tries to answer, is how does 168 conquistadors conquer an empire of 10 million? Like, how on earth is that possible?
Mm-hmm.
What the heck happened?
Well, and I think that's the other thing that's so interesting, and what the book does so well is obviously there's the danger that, you know, we sort of feel like there's a historical inevitability. We know what the outcome of this was. And the book does such a good job of us experiencing it, obviously looking back, but in a certain sense in present tense, so that you're understanding the choices that the Incas are making, the choices that the conquistadors are making. And so you're seeing how, you know, it's constantly this process of the adjacent possible. You know, one decision is made, which makes the next step possible and the next step possible and the next step possible until this, you know, totally unlikely outcome of 168 guys subduing an empire of 10 million actually does happen.
Yeah, it's crazy what happened, and you're right, because now we know what happened, but how did it happen, and you know, what were the techniques they used? And the Spaniards arrived, and they had a lot of advantages. You know, they had gunpowder, they had guns, they had steel. They'd fought the Moors in Spain for forever, basically, and expelled the Moors from Spain, so they were very, very up on their military technology. And they also had writing, which the Incas didn't have, so that mm-hmm. gave them the process, the ability to, you know, much better communication. And they also had the ability to be resupplied, at least not at first, but later from Spain. And they also had they had explored a lot of the planet where the Incas hadn't. So the known empire, the known world for the Incas was the extent of their empire. I mean, where those borders ended, that's all they really knew about the world. And so they had no experience about, you know, the Europe and conquest in other areas. So when the Spaniards arrived in Peru, Cortez had already conquered the Aztec Empire, so he already knew that, and Pizarro knew about Cortez's conquest. So when they arrived, they knew about, and they had conquered other places. They conquered the Canary Islands, and they conquered, you know, different islands in the Caribbean, so they had a whole trail of conquest behind them. So when they arrived, even though there was only 168 of them, they had quite a bit of experience about doing that kind of thing elsewhere in the world, whereas for the Incas, they just had no clue who these people were, and they had never seen horses before, so they were probably as much curious about these people as they were probably a lot less alarmed. And that's a big advantage the Spaniards had. They knew what they were up to, and the Incas had no clue what the Spaniards were up to.
Yeah, and there's always incumbent arrogance, right? Like, any corporation never feels like, the tiny pipsqueak startup could possibly threaten them, and so they never take them seriously until it's too late.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, Incas had they just had a civil war there, so they had massive armies, and they had successfully conquered 3,000 miles of the Andes and part of the Amazon and all the coast, and so they were, they had massive success for 100 years, and they had huge armies of 100,000 people or more, and so why are you going to be worried about 168 men who are, obviously very strange and had some weird animals that arrived on the coast? Why worry about that? It's more, I think the emperor there was probably a lot more curious about who these people were than he was, about any kind of military problem.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that one of the things that I thought was really interesting that came across in the book is just how many of these conquistadors were from Extremadura.
Right. Yeah, 100%. Extremadura is a province of Spain, north central, northwest Spain, and it was still one of the poorest provinces there. And maybe not coincidentally enough, there was probably a good reason to leave since it was so poor. And a lot of the conquistadors that both went to Mexico and Peru had grown up in this province. And, it's just like Sicilians. I mean, if you're from a province of Spain, you're kind of like, you're part of that group, that sub-ethnic group there. So they kind of stuck together as well. So if you were from Extremadura, then you were already kind of accepted into the, the whole conquest area. So Pizarro was from there, and all his brothers, his family were there. All the leaders were. Cortez was from there. So it's kind of interesting that they all kind of, it's almost like, imagine if all the conquistadors, they come from Sicily or someplace like that. That's kind of what it was like. Watch out.
Yeah, and it is that classic thing. I mean, they always talk on Wall Street about poor, smart, and hungry, PSHs, And I mean, that really is who these guys are. They had no chance of advancement in Spain. They were desperate. They were hungry. And, there was a chance for them to get fabulously rich by subduing an empire of 10 million.
Yeah, it's very true. I mean, they came from the bottom of the social pyramid in Spain, and what they were interested was stepping right off onto the top of the social pyramid and down in Peru or whatever empire they could find. They weren't interested in going. Cortez, in before he went to Mexico, he said a famous statement, says, "I didn't come to Mexico to till the land." They had no interest in they were manual laborers who had no interest in pursuing their professions with manual labor if they could help it. They were interested in having all the perks and stuff that went with, with the lease, and they weren't going to do that in Spain, right? Social advancement there was extremely difficult. So they all jumped in boats and went to the New World, and there was rumors swirling around there, especially after the conquest of Mexico, that there might be more empires down south. And so that's how Pizarro ended up there, and that's what they were after, and that's exactly what they did. They went right to the top of the social pyramid, spoiler alert, they captured the Inca emperor, and that's how they ended up controlling, like marionettes, what was below them. That's what they were interested in. They were interested in being on the top.
Yeah, and I mean, and that's one of the interesting things that comes out in Life and Death in the Andes, when you're talking about Peru, is that, this book was really the first book, your book was the first one that was translated into Spanish that really dealt with the conquest of the Inca, and it became a bestseller among the political prisoners in Peru's jails, right? I mean, there were all these, Samizdat photocopied copies of your book that were floating around the cell blocks.
Yeah, I don't know if it became a bestseller in prison. I'm not sure that the prison guards keep those lists, or if they are, they're very covert.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, that was a weird thing that happened. When I was down in Lima working on this last book, I got this email message, because I was down in Peru and had done some interviews down there, and it said, this woman contacted me, she's from this women's group, and she wanted to know if we could meet. And so I was kind of going back and forth. She says, well, she was not just from a women's group, she was from a women's group that was represented prisoners. And then a few more emails, she said, I'm from a women's group that represents prisoners of the Shining Path. So, okay, because, the Shining Path, it still exists in the Amazon there, and so there's no legal organization, and it's only a fraction of what it used to be. So, make a long story short, I met with her, and she brought me a manuscript that they had circulated in prison there, in the women's prison, and it had 1,000 notes in it, and it circulated all through this women's prison of Shining Path prisoners, and it was the first time they'd ever read about their own history, like their own history of the conquest and all that stuff. And they're obviously, of course, they're stuck in prison, so it's like a perfect, he has a perfect audience. Johnny Cash used to play all the songs in prison.
Mm-hmm.
but they had written 1,000 notes in the margins saying like, wow, check this out, or wow, look at this, can you believe this, and that kind of thing. And one of the notes is from the wife of the Shining Path leader, Avema Guzman. It was like she was number two in the organization, so she's in that prison. So yeah, I don't know if it was a bestseller, but they obviously were extremely fascinated by it. And she gave me this card that they'd all signed saying they thanked me for having taken the time to write the true history of the true story of their history. But yeah, it's weird that there had never been anything published in Spanish. I think it's because Peru is still very much doesn't know how to take that story, you know, because they were conquered and yet they're the sons and daughters of the conquerors in a way, at least if you're, you know, if you have European descent. So it's like, it's really kind of a conflicted society. You know, the only statue of Francisco Pizarro is like stuck over in this park. And that's the only place you'll see that in the entire country. Like, what do you think about the founder of your country? I mean, how do you perceive them? So it's partly that too.
Yeah, and I mean, the chapter in the book is Death in the Andes, the Capture of Shining Path Leader Abimael Guzman, right? And I mean, there is this sort of, I mean, you know, the reason why I asked about, you know, did the 80s at all influence your writing of The Last Days of the Inca or your studies there is, I mean, there is this weird sense in which when you go to Peru, you know, you look at the ruling class, they all have 12 Spanish last names, they're all, you know, generally lighter skinned, you know, and then you go out into the hinterlands and they all speak Quechua and all the local native languages. And there is this sense in which, to some extent, you know, the social structure that, you know, Pizarro established in the wake of the conquest of the Inca Empire is kind of still in place.
Yeah, not just there, but it's 100% true. In fact, I remember living there in the 80s, and you'd look in a magazine, for example, you know, Glossy Magazine, they'd be selling the typical stuff, you know, selling washing machines or new cars, and everybody selling the washing machines and new cars were like blonde, white-skinned women. Mm-hmm. And you go, what the heck? There's nobody brown or indigenous in any place in the magazine. It was all these blonde people. And if you put down your magazine and looked around you, it's all these brown-skinned people. So, you know, Pizarro, they, you know, and his men, they took over the very cream, they kicked the cream of Inca nobility off the top of the social pyramid, and they replaced it with themselves. And once they did that, all the rights, all the perks that trickled down from there or rose up from the bottom to them stayed in place. And it pretty much stayed in place in a lot of places in Latin America for the next 500 years. I mean, Peru is not the only place, you know, and it's still true, as you say, if you, you know, the elite of many places in Peru, especially in Lima, still very much, you know, European ancestry. You know, if they go on vacation, you know, a lot of them prefer to go to Europe or something like that. And, you know, none of them are going to go to the Amazon, for example. So it's still very much, the conquest is still very much felt in Peru and Bolivia and Ecuador and countries like that. You know, those social divisions and those conflicts that are introduced by those conquistadors have never left, you know.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the interesting thing, too, is, I mean, you know, talking to some of the people from Hernando de Soto's organization, they were basically saying the degree to which a lot of Peruvians, you know, think that Lima is Peru and, you know, really have no idea of what the rest of the country is like or how the rest of the country even works. But I think that's the interesting thing is that, you know, if you go to that period in the 80s, there are these real social inequalities that exist. And then, you know, the response of, you know, people like Guzman is to say, you know, obviously it's the 80s, so they basically are like, the solution is Maoism or communism or something like that, and then are willing to resort to essentially the sort of guerrilla tactics that the Inca were forced into using because they obviously had no other recourse. It's not like they could file a lawsuit to some sort of international court.
Yeah, no, it's a very good point, and that is that you're making, you know, also the connection between, you know, was there an influence that the Shining Path had, you know, my studies in the Amazon or vice versa. But I mean, I looked at all that history, you know, as an anthropologist, or, you know, my background's biology, anthropology, so, you know, evolution and anthropology. And the elites, I mean, once you invented agriculture, and agriculture, Peru is one of the six areas in the world that actually independently invented agriculture, which is what fueled all of its early civilizations and all the way to the present day. You know, that created the whole social stratification. So it wasn't just like, you know, Pizarro was the latest, you know, elite group, or, you know, the Europeans that went down there were the latest elite group. But if you went back to the Moche or the Chimu or, you know, any of, you know, those earlier civilizations, you had extremely stratified society. And the ones on top were the ones that had all the perks, all the wealth, all the women, all the access to resources. And in some cases, they were so stratified, like the Incas as well. You know, if you were a commoner or if you were, you know, not part of the nobility, you had to practically prostrate yourself before the rulers. And so that's the kind of a civilization that the Spaniards found, and it's kind of like Lord of the Flies a little bit. I mean, they understood it because that's exactly what Europe was like. That's exactly what the nobility and the king and queen in Spain. You know, it wasn't like this is some kind of society they couldn't understand, and that was around the world, whether you're talking about Sumerian or Egyptian or Incan or whatever kind of civilization. Once agriculture increased the food supply and that created stratified societies, in the end you had an elite on top.
Yeah,
and that's exactly what Guzman was trying to get rid of, was that elite. And same with Che Guevara. He said, hey, we want to redistribute the resources in this country differently than it has been for 500 years, and we think the best way is with guns. And that's Che Guevara, you know, had the same idea. So
well, and that's what's so great. I mean, yeah, I mean, you just, when you look through the table of contents of this book, it's like so many epic things, right? Like chapter one, the hunt for Pablo Escobar and the search for El Dorado. I mean, like two amazingly fascinating topics. You got, you know, Darwin and the Galapagos. You've got, you know, obviously the Shining Path. You know, you've got Machu Picchu. You know, you've got all sorts of great stuff about the Inca, Contiki, Lake Titicaca, you know, Che Guevara, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, you know, and then, oh, just to tap it off, the ends of the earth, right? The uttermost part of the earth, Tierra del Fuego. So, I mean, it's just like, I mean, it really is an epic tale all throughout the book. And I mean, yeah, just so that, you know, I mean, obviously, like, people buy this book and read it because it's a great read. And if you want, I think that's always the thing for, you know, nowadays we're all so busy and it's, you know, hard to know which books to read. But like, if you're like, I don't know a whole lot about South America and you want like the greatest hits and a great overview of the entire continent, then I would say Life and Death in the Andes is the book to get. But yeah, I mean, like, let's just hit it up. I mean, like, obviously Pablo Escobar is huge right now, thanks to Narcos and, you know, a million other things. So yeah, I mean, what is the obsession with Pablo Escobar?
Pablo Escobar, I think it's a couple of things, you know, he's also an obsession in Colombia, because Colombia, you know, Narcos is, you know, is out, they've done 10 episodes and they've recommissioned like 10 more, which is a kind of a fictionalized story of his life. But before that, in 2012, they had a similar series down in Colombia, and it was like a massive hit down there. You know, like everybody in the country watched it, and I was down, I guess, in 2013, so like there wasn't nobody didn't know about that. But I think partly it's, you know, Colombia, actually, if you go back in history, they've always appreciated, right? And they had the same conquest. So it's the same story as the Inca Empire. They had, you know, a separate group of conquistadors went there, and they were kind of brutal and rapacious, and they killed all the native leaders, and they were searching for gold, and they were treated terribly. And this one Colombian told me, he says, you know why there's so much violence in Colombia? I said, no. He goes, because we inherited the, you know, we're murderers, or we were founded by murderers, meaning the first Spaniards. So they have this very similar kind of take there. I just forgot where I was going with that. Sorry.
That's part of the fascination with Pablo Escobar, right? I mean, there is this tradition of Robin Hood figures.
Yeah, sorry. Long tradition of Robin Hood-like figures. And, you know, that was the search for El Dorado. You know, the Spaniards were obsessed by gold. And they were obsessed for as long as they were there until they got kicked out, basically. But Pablo Escobar is like the latest in the Robin Hood-like characters, the latest in the El Dorado-like characters. Here's a guy that came from rags to riches, you know, was the seventh wealthiest person in the world, according to the Forbes, you know, list of billionaires. And so people are intrinsically fascinated by that story, just like Escobar. One of Escobar's heroes is Al Capone, who'd done something similar. You know, he was at the top of his game there as far as gangsters go. And the other part is that Escobar, obviously, kind of pioneered the whole cocaine industry into the United States. I mean, he's the guy that opened the floodgates and figured out how to make it, you know, a massive operation as opposed to a trickle. So he's had this enormous effect in that sense. And since he started that, then, you know, everybody and their brother, every cartel, you know, has followed suit, including the Mexicans now. But he pioneered that, so he had an enormous effect in the United States. So it's a kind of a twin thing, the rise and fall of a guy, you know, that rose to the very heights and what brought him down, and also a person who, you know, has had enormous impact for worse with the whole drug trade around the world. He pioneered it.
Well, it's kind of amazing that the Nobel Prize hasn't been awarded to him yet. You know what I mean?
Well, if you're in the drug world, you know, it's like that hit list or the bestseller list in the prison you're telling me about.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Another, you know.
On the Silk Road, on the dark net,
he would be in the Hall of Fame, the Narco Hall of Fame, for sure.
Yeah, I'm surprised they don't do that. Wing. If they have the Ig Nobel Awards and the Darwin Awards, why has somebody not done the Narco Awards?
The Drug Awards. Yeah. Hey, who were the best? Who were the best at their game? Well, he was one of them.
Yeah, no, I mean, 100%. Yeah. And I think, you know, I mean, we interviewed Freeway Rick Ross, who really pioneered crack in you know, L.A. And he, I mean, it's just interesting. I mean, you know, you have these guys who are clearly smart, clearly savvy, but don't really have any opportunity to succeed by rising up a legitimate system. So obviously they end up perverting it and they end up doing all of this illegal activity.
You know, you just hit it on the head. I mean, that's exactly right. Because one of the interesting things about Pizarro, you know, Pizarro and those other conquistadors, you know, they were from the bottom of the social pyramid. They had no pedigree. They were peasants, you know, and artisans and that kind of thing. And one of the first things that Pizarro did once he conquered his empire, and not just him, but all of his, you know, his cohorts at the top, they petitioned in Spain to get all these, like, titles of nobility, mm-hmm. you know, Knights of the Order of Malta and all this kind of stuff. And that was probably the first thing they thought of once they got wealth was, now I want the titles. And that's exactly what brought Escobar down. Escobar, you know, he had all the money. He was on the Forbes list, seventh, you know, wealthiest billionaire on the planet, but that was not enough. The next thing he wanted was a title. He wanted to be a president of Colombia.
Right.
And that desire for recognition, for bootstrapping yourself up and wanting to enter the top of the social pyramid, not just economically, but socially, is what brought him down, because the top of the pyramid didn't want to have anything to do with him.
Well, and that's the point, is that then the way that he'd risen gave the top of the pyramid all the legitimacy they needed to bring him down. And I think that's the interesting thing, too. I mean, so putting on your anthropologist hat, right, the Robin Hood aspect of it, because, you know, obviously Escobar, you know, messed up the country, made a whole bunch of money dealing drugs, like executed a bunch of people. And, you know, in the book, you talk about the cop who was offered a $6 million bribe to leave Escobar alone or would be killed. And he chose to, you know, give up the $6 million bribe and managed to actually catch Escobar. But there is always this sort of Robin Hood element to a lot of these figures. And it reminds me a lot of what you see with band level societies, where you get the big man, and the big man, you know, doles out largesse, he doles out food, he holds feasts, he does all of this stuff that Escobar and these other Robin Hood figures are doing. And it's essentially a way to establish legitimacy in a sort of very pre-modern way, almost.
Yeah, very pre-modern, probably very ancient way. I know from some of your podcasts, you've had people on there talking about the whole notion of, like, spending and that kind of thing. And males especially, like, they waste all this. I heard one podcast you did, I forget exactly with who, but, you know, males tend to spend, you know, buy excess in cars and that kind of thing, and you link it to bower birds and things like that, you know, to attract females. And wealth, you know, all through the North America and the Western Coast, you had this thing called the potlatch, where you'd have everybody would give some of their wealth, some of their produce and stuff to the chief of a tribe, like, say, in the Pacific Northwest. But then once a year or twice a year in these set times, he would just give it all away. They would have these massive, massive feasts. And the Incas did exactly the same thing, that these massive festivals that the Inca Empire would preside over. They just, everybody get drunk. They would just give away cloth and clothing and food and that kind of stuff. And it's part of establishing reciprocity. So Escobar, as demented as he was, he was very crafty, otherwise he wouldn't become top of the Medellin cartel, among a whole bunch of other ruthless thugs, but he understood politics. And so locally, he gave a lot of stuff away. He gave money to the poor. He understood intrinsically the necessity of reciprocity.
Mm-hmm.
And not saying, he did it for political reasons, and of course, if you didn't agree with that, then he would break your arm or shoot your mother or something like that, but he was a crafty fellow, so there is a connection between all those things. You know, ancient society, the potlatch in North America, you know, what Escobar was doing, what the Incas were doing. Everybody on the top understands that if you're just going to isolate yourself and give nothing out, you're probably not going to last very long.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the interesting thing. I mean, because, you know, how well, I mean, even if you look at Washington, right? I mean, you know, so much of it is pork barrel spending. You know, they're constantly trying to figure out things to give back to their constituencies, like, what bridge can I build to nowhere that, you know, will provide a bunch of construction jobs?
Yeah, Escobar did the pork barrel thing, but then, you know, if you didn't agree with it, he would break your arm or shoot you between the eyes, or,
well,
you know, drag your mother, or drag you through a furnace, you know. So he added that to it, and Washington's not as bad, but yeah, it's the exact same psychology. And interestingly enough, you know, one thing that brought down the Spaniards is, again, spoiler alert, but, you know, the conquistadors went down there, they conquered this empire, and then they were just pretty much, you know, let's say 140% just interested in extracting the wealth and either exporting it to Spain or just maintain it themselves. The whole notion of reciprocity, which was up and down the Andes and went back for thousands of years, they did not get it all. And that's one thing that created the Last Days Incas devotes a bunch of chapters, this massive Inca rebellion that occurred after the conquest and fought them for more than four decades afterwards. Part of that was just the Incas finally understood that these people have, reciprocity is not, they have no interest in, despite their lives and that kind of thing, they're not interested in us whatsoever. They're just going to exterminate us. And that created not only a rebellion among the Incas, but it created a rebellion among some of the later coming Spaniards who got there and it was too late to get a share of it. And the ones that already had were wealthy did not want to share their money. That created a massive Spanish rebellion or a rebellion against the conquistadors. So they were very smart, the conquistadors. They were very good at military, but they were not so great at politics.
Well, and I think that's the interesting thing, right? I mean, I think if we were talking 50 years ago, we would say, oh, this was a failure to understand the specific culture of the Inca. But it's not. It's like a fundamental aspect of human psychology, that idea of reciprocity. And, if you violate that reciprocity often enough, then people become done with the relationship and, want to punish you and kick you out and do all that sort of stuff. So it's really, it's a much more fundamental failure on the part of the conquistadors to not understand that universal human psychology.
Yeah, and it extends to their treatment of, Inca religion. I mean, that reciprocity was not just between societies within Inca Empire or villages or communities. It was related to their whole perception of the universe, and they had a whole, they were not monotheistic. They had a, panoply of gods, and they believed that their universe was controlled. All the resources within water and land and crops and animals were controlled by a big, diverse set of gods. And if they did not pay attention to those gods and those spirits, and if they did not have a reciprocal relationship with them, that they did not give them offerings, and the gods would give them nothing back and would withhold. So when the Spaniards arrived and sent their priests in there, and the first thing the priests did was start to knock down their temples and, defile their most sacred sites and that kind of thing, that did not go over very well with the Incas either, with the local culture. So it was a cross-the-board kind of arrogance and misunderstanding and, lack of appreciation for what was there, and a fundamental misunderstanding of how societies worked in terms of reciprocity. And that caused the Spaniards a lot of grief. And it's the reason for, in the end, probably a large part of the Shining Path, because that pervasive tendency, Pizarro founded a capital on the coast so they could export goods to Spain and have, it was about supply or about trading, whereas the Inca capital is up in Cusco, up in the top of the Andes. So, they just misunderstood the whole thing about reciprocity, and that cost them dearly.
Right. And I mean, ultimately, right, so I mentioned Hernando de Soto. Hernando de Soto's book, The Other Path, is an explicit response to The Shining Path, and is basically to say, the problem is not capitalism. The problem is that we have a society that doesn't allow basically the poor to participate in capitalism and to be a part of society. And that is, it's sort of that is really the piece that was missing, right, is that the response was not necessarily to destroy hierarchy, but to create maybe a more flexible hierarchy that allows people to rise up, without having to resort to drug dealing or being a conquistador or, whatever other crazy things people have to do to try and get ahead.
100%. And, as much as I, lambaste the Spaniards and the conquistadors, because we're talking about people back in the 16th century, if you compare it to, North America, what happened here is talk about lack of reciprocity. I mean, when the North Americans or the Europeans first hit America, and then all the way until they pushed the West Coast, they wiped out, as it was genocide. And the same thing happened down, in Chile and Argentina, below, far south of the Inca Empire, where there were no state empires. It was very similar to kind of history to what happened in North America. People were not interested in, forget about reciprocity, they were not interested in having Native American peoples on the land that they wanted in the first place. And so it was really genocide practice down there. And part of the book, Life and Death in the Andes, I go down and meet one of the last speakers of the language who is the last speaker of a language down there, because they went, her tribe experienced all this, these hundreds of years of colonialism and, depredations. But my point is that the Spaniards they didn't understand reciprocity, but they weren't out there to slaughter the natives. And the reason they were not out to slaughter the natives is because they were interested in controlling the empire the natives had built. Mm-hmm. In North America and down in the southern part of South America, there were no native empires. And so the treatment of those people was really much more like, let's get rid of them. Let's just get rid of genocide, whether it was an official policy. Even if you made a deal with one group of people, then you go around the bluff and there's another group that attacks you. So they just wiped them out. as a consequence, there's very little left down in the southern part of South America as far as a lot of the indigenous culture was wiped out. And the same is true, obviously, in North America. So in Mexico and in the Inca Empire, the Spaniards arrived there. They wanted to control the empire. They did not want to kill all the people because they wanted the people to till the land and produce all these goods and that kind of thing. But because of their lack of understanding of how it works and their own greed, they mismanaged it so badly that the repercussions are still felt 500 years later.
Yeah, and so let's talk about that last Yamana speaker, Cristina Calderon, right? Which, I mean, obviously that sounds like a very traditional native name. But so she's literally the last speaker of this language?
She's literally the last speaker of this language, and, it's not that unusual in this day and time. There were, I think in California, there was like 700 languages before the Europeans arrived. It's really diverse linguistically, and the same for South America. And as these cultures are exterminated, they take their languages with them. And some are exterminated because they got disease and they were small and they disappeared. Some were exterminated for, a whole variety of reasons. But there was a bunch of groups that lived down at the very tip of South America, Tierra del Fuego, which for Europeans, they thought was a very hostile environment. It's cold, terrible winds, ships would sink down there. And if anybody ever got stranded, if you were a European, they'd usually die. They'd die of starvation. And yet this whole area was populated by these hunter-gatherer tribes, a variety of them, that did very well and had done well for thousands of years and knew the landscape, knew how to find all the abundant food that was down there, and they survived quite well. But when the Europeans rounded the horn there on the way to eventually to go after whaling and that kind of thing, they brought diseases with them, and that really hit them hard, a whole bunch of epidemics of measles and whatnot. They started to dwindle in numbers, and some of them have gone extinct, some of the native tribes down there, and in this particular one, there's only one person left that still speaks the language, and she's probably about 86 years old now.
Yeah, it says she was born in 1928.
Yeah, I think, I forget exactly year, but she's in her mid to late 80s, and her sister died about 7 years ago, so she was the only other speaker that she could speak to, but this woman's the last one, and if in the book, one of the reasons I went down there is because not only is she an example of like the last speaker of a language, but three of her ancestors have been captured by the captain of the HMS Beagle, the ship that Charles Darwin went around the world on, and took them back to England for this, to try to teach them English, and with the idea that would civilize them, quote unquote, teach them gardening and how to perform agriculture, and then quote unquote re-release them down in Patagonia, and they would spread the benefits of European civilization down there. So two of those three spoke the same language that this woman who's now in her 80s spoke, and so she's the last kind of living example of that particular story.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty amazing. I mean, and then the whole thing is so sad. I mean, obviously as an anthropologist, I presume that you feel pretty keenly like the loss of this culture.
Yeah, I mean, it's a story that keeps on, it's unfolding, and so she's the last one of that culture. There's like probably about 50 uncontacted tribes still in the Amazon, which is kind of amazing when you think about it, because Columbus arrived in 1492, so there's still like about 50 tribes that have not heard news of his arrival. But, and I don't mean that deprecatingly, they're very remote areas, and they didn't have, wireless and that kind of stuff, but those contacts that are still going on now, and stories like Cristina Calderon, Yamana down at the Tierra del Fuego, those are the same unfolding of the same kind of sad stories that began when Columbus arrived for Native Americans. The first thing hit him was disease, and then kind of greedy colonists, and they got pushed off their land, and they didn't have enough to eat, and they got sick, and they ended up on the bottom of these new social pyramids that the Europeans were very busy constructing. So yeah, it's a very sad story, but I guess kind of the amazing thing is it's still ongoing. Like when a tribe is contacted now in the present day, basically they're receiving the same news that those first tribes received 400 years ago or back, in 1492, 500 years ago.
Well, they might be better off not knowing the news, frankly.
100%.
No news is good news.
No, a lot of anthropologists do exactly the same thing. In fact, there were some anthropologists I knew down in Peru who were very interested in contacting this uncontacted tribe down in Manu National Park in southwestern Peru, which is not that far from Machu Picchu, about 100 miles. And the argument of the Peruvian government is that just leave them alone. They're going to be contacted one day, but why spoil, why have all the usual stuff happen to them that we know it's going to happen? And so they didn't contact them back in the 80s. And that tribe now, we're almost 30 years later, is now starting to be contacted. I think, well, at least the last 30 years, that tribe could live in peace and weren't exposed to, you know, measles and whooping cough and that kind of stuff. So her story, Christina's story, down at the end of Tierra del Fuego, is kind of the sad end result of the last bit of that process unfurling, unfortunately, for that particular tribe in that particular area of the world. She is the last remnant. When she dies, that language is going to be extinct.
Well, and I mean, I think it's also, I mean, to go back to, I mean, you know, Pizarro, the first thing that he wants once he succeeds is that he wants titles. I mean, you know, the quest for dignity is incredibly important. And I think that's the problem is that within their tribe, they've figured out a stable system in which people can get a lot of dignity. But, you know, to then be incorporated at the bottom of a large social ladder that they have relatively little chance of rising up. I mean, you're essentially, all you're doing is robbing these people of dignity.
Yeah, you're robbing them of their resources, which obviously is totally tied to their dignity. You know, it's interesting, you know, talking about Lima and like comparing it to Los Angeles. The difference is that Lima is, you know, kind of the outgrowth of all the indigenous peoples from different cultures that went there to get a job. Basically, mm-hmm. You know, it started as a little kind of white, you know, Spanish colonial city, but then people started to show up there to get jobs, you know, hundreds of years ago. And it's this massive city now. And the people are from different cultures. They're from the Amazon. They're from different parts of the Andes. You know, originally, they spoke all kinds of languages. But back in, I don't know, it was about 10, 15 years ago, I was actually up this river in the southern part of Peru and I went up a river where there's a recently contacted Machigenga tribe, which is another tribe there. And there's different ones that are uncontacted. And I'd been with this tribe briefly, and they had basically hardly any contact with the outside world. I mean, they were establishing it. I remember going down the river there in this boat. You could see this tribe, you know, arrayed along this kind of a bluff on the riverbank, you know, wearing their traditional kushmas and their face paints and that kind of stuff. And within a day, I was like in a mission city in the Amazon there where, you know, the missionaries had been there, the Catholic missionaries for, I don't know, 50 years. And then I took a flight to, you know, from there to Lima. And you realize that in Peru, you can still see like the tribes, they're just being contacted now. Then you see like the missionization cities or the cities where they're, you know, being acculturated. But then when you get to Lima, suddenly you're like, you're walking down the street and there's all these brown people and mm-hmm. most of them, almost all of them don't speak any kind of, you know, they don't speak a native language anymore for the most part. In other words, they're wearing suits, they're wearing regular city clothes and all that kind of stuff because even if they speak their language, they're trying to fit in. Mm-hmm. You just see the whole acculturation process of like 500 years just in that trip from that jungle village all the way to Lima. And so Lima is very much like this cultural melting pot in the sense that this is where people go to kind of lose their culture and join the national culture and lose their languages and that kind of thing, which is, you know.
But also create something new. I mean, I think, you know, the Lima has sort
great
of become...
Food.
Yeah, exactly. It's become one of the great culinary capitals of the world. There's so much interesting stuff happening there. And it really is. I mean, again, like, what I hadn't realized before I went there is that there were 1 million Chinese who came into Peru and then pretty much just became blended into the culture. So you see all over the place these chifa places, which sell, you know, sort of like Peruvianized Chinese food. But even like lomo saltado, which is like the great national dish of Peru, apparently began as like Chinese food that they were trying to, it's like their chop suey, basically.
Yeah, and I don't mean, I'm, you know, because you've been talking a lot about the conquest, and the conquest is a sad story, but I mean, Peru is a tremendous country. It's my favorite country in South America. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just got such a tremendous diversity. You know, they call, there's the thing called El Peru Profundo, which is all the layers and the depths of those different worlds I was talking about. You know, you can just spend years there, you know, looking into it, and there's just so much to explore. And one of the great things, I'm a big gourmet eater, and Peru has fantastic food. And it's for all those reasons you said. They've tapped into the indigenous wealth of plants and spices and that kind of thing. And it's had a huge kind of renaissance. I mean, it was always good. It was good back in the 80s. You went and had fantastic food there, but it wasn't really known outside of the world. Mm-hmm. And there's this one chef called Gaston Acurio, who is a Brazilian chef, and he's blown up huge. He has restaurants all around the world, and he's put fusion elements together. But you're right, the Chinese came over, and they brought their culture there, and that created a chifa food, and then all the background for Inca and pre-Inca, you know, indigenous cultures using all this fantastic fruits from the Amazon. They've rocked it. They have the best ceviche in the world, and just like it's tremendous. And now Lima is one of the culinary capitals. That's the culinary capital of all South America, and deservedly so. So I mean, it is a fantastic thing to sample, and it's a fantastic country to visit.
And I mean, that's the other thing too. I mean, there's literally so much to deal with, but like one of the other things that I think is important to realize is, as you said earlier, like the Inca Empire had only been around for 90 years when the Spanish arrived. So, you know, 90 years earlier, the Incas had fucked over a whole bunch of other tribes and civilizations that, you know, are now wiped off the map. So, I mean, but that's, I think that's the interesting thing. I mean, you know, as we talk to lots and lots of amazing people like yourself, is that constantly you realize that there's this process where everybody fucks everybody over, but as the ideas cross-pollinate, as essentially the ideas fuck each other, things get better. You know, you get these interesting fusion elements in food, you know, you get better and better civilizations that are more inclusive and more democratic. And, you know, so hopefully there's a process of progress with all this mixing and this cross-pollinating, even if there's a lot of pain and suffering along the way.
Yeah, no, I agree 100%. And it's like New York City is an epitome of that. I mean, New York City, where there was indigenous people living there, and of course now you have this thing I consider a fantastic city. In the United States, I remember I was there with an anthropologist friend, like back in the 90s, and we'd just done this hour-and-a-half special for Discovery, which had this Machi Genga Indians in this special. And there was a big bus went down, a city bus, and on the side it was advertising the Discovery show with the Machi Genga Indians. And I remember turning to him going, okay, now the Machi Gengas are here. You know, that's like the final piece. You know what I mean? New York is like America, New York, and, you know, all these different cities, these globalized cities have these cultures of the yin-yang, and it does make for, you know, because New York is a fascinating place. And you go to Lima, it's a fascinating place. And La Paz, Bolivia is a fascinating place, and in large part because you have all this admixture of these different ethnicities jostling and mixing together. And the Inca Empire was very similar. Cusco was the global capital of South America back then, at least Western South America. You had ethnic representatives from all over the empire. And they, you know, I said the Incas were a lot better about the reciprocity. If they conquered an area and that area submitted peacefully, they would keep the local indigenous, the pantheon of religious icons and gods in place. They would keep their rulers in place. The ruler's son would go to Cusco and study about what the Incas were all about. So you had people from all over the empire mingling around Cusco, which must have been just a fantastic place. It was the New York City of its day, you know. So, yeah, that process is continuing on a global scale now.
Yeah, and so, I mean, we have to wrap it up, but I do have one last question, partly because I just want to give a sense of the scope of the book and just, you know, how many fun, great stories there are in it so that people will go out and buy it and read it. But the what is the deal with Che Guevara? Like, why are people so obsessed with Che Guevara? I mean, there's always been, I mean, obviously Pablo Escobar is also in here. Like, people do love these sort of, you know, counterculture bandit, like, anti-heroes. But, like, Che Guevara, is it just that picture? Is that why everybody knows Che Guevara and he's so romantic? Or did the picture just tap into something else there? I mean, why Che Guevara? I just don't get it.
That's funny. Yeah, I think it's kind of like what makes a bestseller. You know, you could take one book and publish it in 1930 and it might do fantastic. If you publish the same book in 1972, it might not, you know, do it. Mm-hmm. I think it's a very similar story. At the time, you know, he was a revolutionary leader. He was this Fidel Castro's, you know, second-hand man. That was a big deal in the news media about the whole takeover of a communist takeover of an island right on America's shore. So it got an enormous amount of press. Of all those Cuban leaders, other than Fidel Castro, the only one anybody can name to this day is like Che Guevara, right? Mm-hmm. It's because he was second in command and he was the good looking guy. He looked like he was meant for Hollywood. He was fantastic, you know, all the women kind of swooned over him and he had a ton of charisma, you know, and that's why he could lead, you know, groups of men and stuff. Was he a great revolutionary leader? No, he made so many mistakes in Bolivia, it's not even funny. He wasn't actually very good leading his own group, you know, in some other country. He was very good as Castro's right-hand man. But I think it hit the times. He was a massive amount of press associated with that. Mm-hmm. He was a very charismatic fellow, and Castro sent him around the world to be a representative of the revolution. So he was a guy going to New York and Europe and China, and so he was ending up with all the photo op. There's like this massive publicity tour. Mm-hmm. And then it just, like, you know, anything, it kind of goes viral. His image, more than anything, went viral. And now his image is kind of separated from his story, which is why I went and looked into his story, because what is the story of Che Guevara? Who was this guy really? You know, because everybody knows about the image, but they don't know really what that image is represented on. You can go to countries around the world and they're wearing T-shirts with this guy's face, but you ask them, you know, who is that? Well, I don't know, Che, cool guy, guy. That's about all they know. So,
yeah, and
that's why I think it was the right time at the right place with the right face. And I think had he been ugly, like I'm just saying disparaging about, you know, Fidel's brother, but his brother was not a good looker, and he was like number two, number three in the organization. Nobody cared about him.
Well, that's why Raul has been in the shadows, and I really shouldn't say this because I'm going to Cuba next week, but like Raul has been in the shadows literally until the last 2-3 years.
Yeah, you got to be good looking if you want to be viral, you know, as far as a revolutionary hero. I mean, Guzman was a lot more adept at leading revolution, but again, wasn't a good looker.
Yeah.
Well, but also, he was smart enough. Like, one big flaw that happened with Che, and even more so with Escobar, you know, Escobar created publicity. And if you're a narco trafficante, that's a really bad thing you need to crave. You want to be really low key, that kind of thing. Guzman had learned from, you know, Che Guevara's mistakes, and he kept very, very low key, so nobody even knew who he was. They didn't know, you know, he wasn't running around the world getting publicity. He was trying to keep it all under wraps about who even ran the organization. So to sum it up, right place, right time, a lot of publicity, hit it right, you know, at the right time, he went viral.
Well, that's why, you know, Pablo Escobar should have taken a page out of the book of Gustavo Fring from Breaking Bad.
100%. I'm with you there.
Listen, you know, I am going to call you Professor Macquarie, even though, you know, no university has had the foresight or wisdom to recognize you as such.
I do have a master's, but not a PhD, so.
Well, then even better, we'll call you Master of the Universe Macquarie, you know, heir to the Inca Empire. The last Inca emperor. No, I mean, it's been such a fantastic pleasure. And I mean, the book is really fantastic. We really only scratched the surface. I mean, there's just so much great stuff in there. We didn't get to talk about the Kon-Tiki, which, you know, there's a fascinating Norwegian, or Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, or, you know, I mean, Darwin. I mean, there's so much great stuff in there. I mean, I think that's the thing. I mean, it's such a great book for anybody who really wants to get an overview of South America and really get like a lot of just fun stories that you can tell at a cocktail party and show off how smart you are. So if you like having people think that you're really smart and well-read, read this one book, and then you will just have loads of material to, you know, intellectually dominate other people and make them laugh and cry. And, you know, in Grand Brian Callen style, never give the actual author credit, Kim Macquarie. And yeah.
That's funny.
Yeah.
Just really quickly, you know, if you look up the Kon-Tiki, you know, Kon-Tiki, there's a replica of that Voyager's 2 raft that set off just a few weeks ago from Peru going out to Easter Island. That's going to be going on for the next few months. So that Voyager's being repeated as we
speak. So nuts. Yeah. Well, not with me, it won't be repeated. they're more than welcome.
I appreciate your comments. Obviously, I recommend the book. If you do want to find out something about South America in one book, that's one reason I put it together, because it's the kind of book I would have liked to have read before I went.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, how do I get kind of a grip on like a whole lot of things in South America and all the kind of, you know, the top pop stories that would really help me understand that continent? That's what the idea behind the book is. So I appreciate you recognizing that.
Yeah, I mean, it's awesome, and like such a fun read too. And, you know, also we'll recommend the country of Peru. So, you know, read.
Not to disparage, I love Bolivia. I love all the countries down
all
there.
Of them. Yeah.
I love the continent. South America's a fantastic place. So,
yeah.
If you haven't been there, you should go.
So, read Life and Death in the Andes, read The Last Days of the Inca, and then, you know, go visit somewhere in South America or all of South America. Just recreate his journey. That's what you should do. Just, you know, work your way down the spine of the continent.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Master of the Inca, last great emperor, Kim Macquarie.
I should be like a Spaniard. No, that's okay. Get up off your knees.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks so much.
A recent conquest. Thank you. Thanks.
Talk to you soon.
Bye.
Awesome. Ladies and gentlemen, this has been the Brian Callen Show without Brian Callen. This whole interview has made me incredibly nervous, because apparently if you're ridiculously attractive, then your revolutionary movement is bound to succeed. And, you know, let's just hope that Brian Callen is actually acting right now instead of planning some sort of Maoist insurgency. Because if he is, then we're all in big trouble. All right. Talk to you soon. Thanks so much.
You've been listening to the Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.